Welcome, Greg. Greg Ward is the founder and executive director of Center for Respectful Leadership. Greg is a keynote speaker, consultant, facilitator, trainer, executive coach, and entrepreneur. For over 25 years, Greg has been a beacon of knowledge and insight in the field of respected leadership. His work has powerful and measurable benefits for managers and organizations. He's also the author of several books, most notably the Amazon bestseller, The Respectful Leader, 7 Ways to Influence Without Intimidation. I must add that Greg is a terrific guy. We had a delightful dinner in New York City just last week. Greg is back in beautiful San Diego today. Greg, thank you so much for taking part in this conversation titled Navigating Workplace Bullying, Finding Resilience, and Feeling Joy, Even in Crisis.
Thank you so much for having me, Andy. This is a pleasure and a privilege.
Thank you, Greg. And so, boy, oh boy, do we need all that you are serving up. So, and I need it too, but I think many of us do. So let's get into it. You talk so much about coaching for respect. It seems to be core to your work. You know, why is respect so much a core of what you talk about, what you think about, and what you teach?
That is a great question. Well, our research at the center indicates that what we're seeing now is rather disturbing. We call it public disrespect, where people behave badly and treat each other badly in public. And our research indicates that we haven't seen this kind of public disrespect since the height of the Vietnam War in the late 60s, early 70s. And back then, we didn't have these things that we could all, you know, just instantly look at all that was going on in the world. And so right now we're experiencing an enormous amount of public disrespect, and that is bleeding over, and bleeding is my word, to our workplaces. We're seeing more and more of this inside the workplace where people are bullying each other, treating each other like crap, being incredibly disrespectful and uncivil to each other. That has really serious financial and business consequences when you allow that to happen in any kind of organization. So I find a lot of my work and our work here at the center is working with organizations where bullying, where disrespect, where that this kind of behavior has bubbled up and become a serious problem. And they're smart enough to realize the impact on the organization and they want to do something about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing because I've been involved in media. I've been in television all my career here in New York, major media companies. And it seems so often that it's allowed, maybe not encouraged, but certainly depending on who's doing the bullying or who's causing the toxic culture, in my experience, almost usually from the top, it's very hard to get any kind of movement whereby they look to you to say, hey, we've got a problem. It's counterproductive to the best interest of our business and we need to do something about it. That's the key. And I haven't seen that a lot. So let me just take a little step back and say, this kind of behavior, whether it's bullying, disrespect, microaggressions, however, and I know you deal with all of it, how do you define kind of respectful leadership? We kind of know it when we see it and feel it, the disrespectful kind. What kind of leadership, respectful leadership, are you looking to help companies find?
That's also excellent question, and, right. And one I'm asked a lot. So here's how I like to answer that. First, I want to talk a little, just briefly about the kind of leadership styles that many of us experienced as we were growing up. There were two really common leadership styles. One is, well, I often ask people, did you ever have a mother or father who said, do as I say because I'm your mother, or do as I say because I'm your father? That's called command and control leadership. It's basically, I have the power and authority, you must do as I say. Yeah. And what our research indicates is that 90% of us have experienced that kind of leadership in some way, shape, or form, and 90% of us would prefer not to be led that way. There's always the 10% who want to be told exactly what to do, but most of us don't think that that's a respectful way to lead us. But because it's such a common leadership style, when we get elevated into leadership positions, that's the way we lead as well. So it's very, very common. The other is called carrot and stick, which is basically do as I say, meet this goal, and you'll get a carrot. you'll get a reward. But if you don't, you're going to be in trouble. And so that kind of leadership style is very, very common. And I want to be clear that neither of these leadership styles are incorrect. They should never, I'm not saying don't ever use them. There are situations where command and control leadership is very, very valuable and useful. The example I often give is if you're in the military and you're in the middle of a firefight, we don't have time to stand around and say, well, gee, Andy, what's your opinion? How do you think we should deal with this?
Yeah. Now,
somebody's got to take charge.
Yeah.
Give orders, and that's how lives are saved. And
yeah.
when it comes
yeah.
to carrot and stick leadership, you know, I used to work in telephone sales when I was in college. That's how I paid my tuition. I have the gift of gab. So they set me a goal. I would consistently meet that goal. And that's how I made my money. And that's how I paid my tuition. It worked for me. But most people don't take the job these days, unless they're in sales, on a commission-based structure where it's all carrot and stick. So those two leadership styles, although they're very common, are considered disrespectful by most people, especially our younger Gen Z and millennial generations of employees, which make up roughly 70%. By 2030, 70% of our workforces will be either millennials or Gen Zs. That's a huge number. And they're completely intolerant of the old traditional leadership styles.
Yeah.
So what is respectful leadership? To get back to your question, the simplest way I can describe it is you all know the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's not a bad way to lead. It's actually, by the way, in every sacred text, every culture in the world has some form of do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There's a slight hiccup, though. Everybody wants to be done unto the same way.
Yeah.
It's where what's called the platinum rule. It was developed by Dr. Tony Alessandra, and he wrote a book called The Platinum Rule. And basically, it's a slight variation on the golden rule. It says, do unto others as they would have you do unto them.
Yeah.
So the example I often give is, Andy, if you called me up and said, hey, Greg, next week I've got this big meeting. Can you do a talk on respectful leadership? I'd say, sure, Andy, no problem. Let me see if I'm available. No problem. I will. And just give me the link and we'll make it happen. But and that's fine. That's my style. And I suspect that may be your style, too.
Yes,
but
of course.
I have people who work for me who are very, very knowledgeable about the work we do. And if I call them up and say, hey, I'm not available to help my client, Andy, but can you be available? One of them would say, oh, I don't know, Greg, I'm available, but can I talk to him? And they would spend the whole weekend worrying and preparing to do this talk. They just want to be treated differently. They want more advance notice. They want time to prepare.
Yeah.
It's just who they are. And so what is respectful leadership? It's basically the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And the platinum rule, do unto others as they would have you do unto them, working in concert together.
When
your emotional intelligence switch is turned on. You have to be aware of how others want to be treated in order to use the platinum rule.
It makes so much sense to me. It speaks to me. And so I have so many questions. Let's start with the carrot and the stick thing, or the stick and then the carrot. We all want to be compensated fairly, whatever that means. But it seems to me that no matter what I make, and I acknowledge that for many of the toxic workplaces in which I worked and the bully bosses and the aggressive style of management that they brought on me, I was well paid. But I think to your point about how we would treat others, I wanted to be appreciated. If I did a great job, if I was devoted, loyal, respectful, hardworking, and productive, I didn't just want to get yelled at and threatened to be fired and things like that, get angry emails. I wanted to be appreciated. And I think so many of us care as much or more about that. I mean, I don't think so many people leave jobs because they didn't get a 2% raise. They leave because they're getting hammered emotionally. So I just want to get your sense of that aspect of it, because the carrot ultimately tastes good for a few bites. And then after that, you remember how the stick. So tell me your thoughts on that.
Yes, absolutely. You're right on target. In fact, MIT back in 2022 released the results of a report that the Sloan School of Business did around why did people quit their jobs during the Great Resignation? You may remember that.
Of course.
And we at the center called it the Great Reconsideration for various reasons. But at the end of the day, MIT found that a toxic work environment, a bullying work environment, for example, is 10 times more likely to cause someone to quit than compensation.
Interesting. I had no idea, but that's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's right there in black and white that most people, if they are compensated fairly, what they consider to be fairly, even if it's below market value, and they are treated with acknowledgement, consideration, respect, they're given the flexibility they need to work from home or at the office, to be in a hybrid kind of situation, to be treated as valuable contributors, they value that a great deal. And they're far less likely to leave a job, even if the compensation isn't as good as the people down the street, what they're offering. So at the end of the day, your environment, how you are treated, for most of us, matters a great deal, more than it ever did before. And so you're right on target that compensation is really not the key driver of why people stick around. It's being acknowledged. It's being respected. It's being valued. It's been treated decently and given the flexibility you need to do your job at the best possible capacity.
It just seems to me that that should be, and it's not, but it should be self-evident to managers and leaders that it's only going to behoove them and you're going to get more productivity, more loyalty. It costs a lot of money, and I've been a manager much of my career, and it costs so much time and so much money to replace someone than it does to treat people well. The people, and again, we're not talking about somebody who shows up to work drunk and late and doesn't handle assignments. We're talking about good, loyal, devoted employees. So let me ask this. In your work, Greg, when companies call on you because they've got a problem, and maybe they acknowledge a toxic culture, I'm not sure. Can you give me some real world examples of the kinds of behaviors you're hearing in the companies that are bringing you in and how you begin to turn it all around?
Sure. Let me tell you one example that I often refer to. A number of years back, I got a call from a head of HR of a very large technology company, and I can't say the name of it, but she said to me, "Hey, Greg, I need your help with our chief technology officer." And I said, "Okay, what's going on?" And first she said, "Well, look, you got to understand he's really well known. He's written a bunch of books and he goes around the world, talking about technology at conferences and stuff. He's considered, you know, a guru in the field." And I'm like, "Wow, he sounds like a rock star. What's the problem?" And she said, "Well, no one wants to work with this guy."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, he has revolving door staff." And, and she said, "I'll give you an example. If you're in a meeting with him and you ask him a question, he might say, 'I'm not going to answer that because you won't understand.' Or if you knock on his door to ask a question, he'll say, 'What do you want?' with that tone of voice." So she said, "It's terrible. He's this really senior level person. And no one wants to work with him. And we're constantly have to replace his staff. There's turnover. There's complaints. It's just an absolute mess. Can you fix him?"
Okay.
And my response is, "Well, how long has he been doing this?" And she said, "Well, he's one of the founders of the company." And I went, okay, hang on a second. Let me check my schedule. "No, I'm sorry. I'm not a..."
You want to go anywhere near that? Yeah.
I can't help you for 45 years. If you could wait that long, I'll help you. No, you know, this is the challenge. I often get the call with this kind of story. We've got a senior executive. We value this person enormously. They brought so much good. They brought in so much revenue. They have the best relationships with our customers, yada, yada, yada. He's a rock star, but he or she is causing all sorts of headaches and problems and upset and turnover. And we need you to fix them. That is the constant quest I have. And the problem is, it always comes too late. They always wait until there's a lawsuit happening, there's some kind of massive complaint that everybody's talking about, it's in the media, it's in the industry press, and it's getting out there, and that's too late. That is too late. My usual response is, sooner or later, you're going to have to get rid of this person, despite, you know, their connections and what they brought into the company, because sooner or later, if they're that high level and you've allowed and enabled this behavior to go on this long, it's going to become too costly to your reputation. You're going to have to get rid of them. Your best bet is to go after them with both barrels blazing and say, you either change or you're out. But so many of my clients are too afraid to take that step.
And yeah.
So it's a major problem.
And let me just, before you tell me how you address this guy, did you get a sense from the people that were asking whether you'd be available to help? Did it seep throughout the organization? Because in my experience, if a top guy, whether it's a rainmaker, CEO, founder, and like, who's going to walk to his office and say, cut it out? Nobody. So was it a toxic culture as well, or was it just this one guy?
It was a toxic culture. And yet, because they were so successful, this is the challenge. There are many companies that, despite their toxic culture, despite they've got a bullying CEO or somebody in a senior leadership position, they are still very, very successful.
Yeah.
So there's this attitude of, that's just him, that's just her, just everybody ignore them, it'll be okay. But that behavior trickles down and everybody knows it. And so it becomes a toxic environment, and you're probably going to see the metrics with that kind of an organization. You're going to see higher levels of turnover, higher levels of complaints, issues around productivity and collaboration and teamwork, because that kind of behavior impacts an entire organization. So you want practical ways to address this. One of the things that I suggest, even if I'm not going to try and coach this person, is find somebody on the leadership team who this individual actually respects and will listen to, and coach them on coaching that person.
So yeah.
I might coach that individual and say, look, here's how you take this person aside. Here's how you drive behavioral change. But at the end of the day, when a person reaches that senior most level, there is not some kind of sword of Damocles involved that if you don't change, then you're out. If that's there, they don't really see why they should change, because look where they've gotten this behavior. So can't say that I blame them. It doesn't make sense to them. Why should I change? I've achieved the senior most position. I've been really successful. And now you're telling me I need to change because some people are offended. They don't get it. They don't.
Well,
get
right.
It.
No. And in my experience in television, I never saw where somebody like you come in and try to change it. I've never seen that. But I also never saw the bully bosses that I worked for saying, you know, having some kind of epiphany. And all of a sudden they're contrite and they're going around the building apologizing. I've never seen that happen, but I guess in your work, obviously, it can happen.
It can. Usually two things. If I've got a client who is reasonably self-aware.
Yeah, and that's what it takes.
Yeah, that's what it takes. It takes a little self-awareness, a willingness to accept the possibility that maybe they are behaving in ways that really are destructive. If they're willing to be slightly self-aware, and secondarily, if they're aware, and this is the primary motivator, that they could derail their career if they don't change, then they're more anxious to come to me and listen to me and change. The trick is, with them, people will change if A, they they are being asked to change in a way that they can actually do it. They can accomplish it. It's not pie in the sky. Hey, you are no longer going to bully anyone ever. You're never going to have a harsh word with anyone in this company. Well, that's an impossible ask. But if the change is something they can do, and B, if there's something in it for them,
yeah,
it's positive, then it's likely you can get them to change. But that takes work, and it takes a willingness to change. It
yeah.
takes a willingness to have respect to some outsider. They don't even know me. And a willingness to accept the possibility that this outsider might be able to help them salvage their career. Surely there's someone in their life who has said to them, maybe it's their spouse or their partner or their child.
Yeah.
Someone in their life has said, you know, dad, mom, friend, you're being kind of a jerk.
Yeah.
And maybe someone has said that, and I might be able to draw upon that and start to leverage a change. It's not easy.
Yeah.
A lot of the times it's not possible, but I'll always give someone the benefit of the doubt of the possibility that they can change.
Yeah. And a strong argument that you made previously is if you don't want to change for yourself, change for your business. But as you said, then there's the counter argument, hey, I'm doing just fine, you know, because a lot of these guys that I've come across are making millions of dollars and so forth. So let me ask you this, because we're talking about respectful leadership. And I want to ask you a little bit more about your book, The Respectful Leader. And I find it so interesting because you describe it as a business fable because it's fiction. But I got to tell you, I've been reading it. And it reads like nonfiction to me. Tell us a little bit about it. And then I want to ask you about the first scene of the book.
Well, thank you very much. When I first came up with the concept for The Respectful Leader and writing it as a business fable, I was looking around at the literature out there about respect. And there really isn't very much, to be honest with you, in terms of in the business environment. And the second thing I noticed is that anything that was there was very academic. It was very deep. It was lots of big tomes and texts. And I thought, you know, my clients don't have time to read that kind of stuff. But what they do appreciate is a good story. And so I'm a storyteller myself. I worked as a journalist for many years. I also am a writer, in a fictional writer and playwright and so on. And I thought, well, let me see if I can craft a story, a believable story that's based on my clients and the people that I've worked with and coached over the many years. And so I just set it in a fictional company that looks a lot like many of the client companies that I've worked with over the years. And all the characters are based on real people, including the main character, the young CEO of this company, and including his boss, the head of the conglomerate that bought his company. And some of the other characters are all based on real people and, you know, change them slightly. And they don't know it's based on them, but I tried to make it as realistic as possible so that people who are reading it, especially those in leadership roles who are thinking, this doesn't apply to me. Hopefully they read it and they go, yeah, I've seen that before. Oh, yeah, I know that kind of person. I know that behavior. I've seen that before. So what's your question about the opening chapter?
Well, so I didn't really appreciate how real your book is and was. So I'm reading it, and the first scene is just as you talk about. There's this young CEO. He's just under 40 years old. He's just gotten this plum job, and he's running a big company, multi-million dollar company, and he's feeling great, as anyone would, with a new role and a new start, and he's making a great salary, and his wife calls him, congratulations, honey, and what a life. And he's sitting there, and of course, it's that point where, you know, work is great until you have to start to work. So he's about to go to his first meeting. I mean, I want to tell the audience this. You, of course, know this. And he's about to go to his first meeting with his staff. And before he does, and he's feeling great about himself, the big boss, the conglomerate boss, his boss calls him and says, look, get going, turn this thing around or else, basically. I mean, he's hardly even started. He doesn't even know where the bathroom is, let alone where the first meeting's being held. And the guy's already saying basically like, hey, you're on the clock. Let's go get it together. And if you can't do it, basically I'll find someone else who will. And, the reason, and I won't go into my whole history, but I think it's apropos here. I was starting a new job at the Wall Street Journal, and I was interim global head of video. And so I was interim. So if I did a good job, I'd become the global head of video at the Wall Street Journal, the pinnacle of my career. And there was a guy there who was not even my boss, but who had a lot of power for reasons that none of us were really sure, but who had my interim status in his hands. And if he said yes in a month or 2 months or 3 months, I would become the glue. And I was in the first week of the job. And it was the first week of the last week of the new year. And it was New Year's Eve. And my wife and I were in a movie for New Year's Eve. And I get a text and he's like, you've been, and the text said, I see, the text comes in. It says, you've been in the job for 4 days or 5 days, whatever it was already. What the hell is going on? Because he had told me he wanted me to fire everybody. He wanted me to make wholesale changes. He had a guy who he wanted to become my number two, his pet guy. I mean, and I just turned to my wife and I said, we have to leave. It ruined our New Year's Eve, obviously. Oh, sure. And I mean, I had been in the job 4 days.
Talk about passive aggressive. Why is he doing this on New Year's Eve, right? I mean.
And it just continued. It continued and continued and continued. And a lot changed after that. But it was just this thing of like, I was just in the job and he's already telling me that how come massive changes haven't occurred, you know, and I'm 4 days into the job. So that's exactly what's happened to your guy. I was like, oh, can't I just, you know, get a feel. So what you're writing about,
get a feel yeah. of the place. Yes.
Right.
That's what a reasonable person would do. You just wouldn't just come in and on day one, you know, hand everybody and replace them. I mean, that doesn't make sense. But this was about power. This guy wanted to wield over you.
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you, Andy. There are some folks, they're just sociopaths. I'm not a psychologist, but I'm going to use that word. There are just people in positions of the highest levels of power. They're narcissistic sociopaths. I can't fix them. Nobody can fix them.
Yeah.
And the best thing the organization to do is throw some money at them and get them the hell out of there. That's the best you can do because they're eventually going to bring the whole organization down. And we've seen story after story about massive big leaders and their egos just bringing the organization to its knees.
Yeah. And I tried to protect my staff from this kind of management or mismanagement. But it was hard because he'd go directly to them without me even knowing and start telling them, you know, so it was just awful because in these circumstances, I was kind of accustomed to it being in television. And part of it, Greg, which you and I have talked about, part of it was like, well, didn't I ask for this? And, you know, we're New York media and all. And what I've learned as I've gotten into some of this work and gotten to talk to some of the leading experts like yourself in this arena is it's happening in industries. It's not just TV in New York. And that might have been kind of egotistical on my part to think. But so much of it, I thought, well, somehow something I'm doing is bringing this on. And so I guess you've started to address it and you feel so alone. And I don't understand. Look, we all have bad days. I was a boss. I had my bad days where I pounded a table or two. I wasn't patient with people. I don't know how often I lost my temper, not very often at all over years and years. But what I'm wondering is why do people act this way when, like you said, maybe they're narcissists, sociopaths, but it's just so counterproductive. I think in my case, they have no idea the harm they're doing. I think they go on and maybe they feel good, but I think they go on with the rest of their day. And meanwhile, I go home and I can't digest my food. I can't sleep, all these things. So in your setting, you're on the inside. Can you sense why they do this at all?
You've touched on it. Many people are not aware. They simply lack the emotional intelligence to be aware of how their behavior is impacting others and aware of what's going on with them. Because who's taught about emotional intelligence in school? None of us are taught about that. You have to study it. It's a part of a leadership curriculum. And even then, it's not often covered in great detail. So developing emotional intelligence is a skill to have high emotional intelligence. That's part of the problem. But again, what we also see is people are very often promoted into leadership roles because they get stuff done.
Yeah.
And they sometimes they'll roll right over other people, but the other leadership at the top, they go, look at what they got done. They must be good. And they make things happen and they bring in the business and they win the clients. Well, at the end of the day, the treatment of others becomes less important than winning the business and maintaining the revenues and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
People, it's what our leaders value. And when you work in an organization where the leaders value not only revenues and results, but they also value respect and treating people well. Oh, that's golden. That is a golden organization. And you will find people staying with that kind of an organization for decades because they feel valued and supported and respected. Even though they may not be paid at the highest levels, they are extremely loyal. And that organization is still very, very, very successful.
Yeah, I know you focus on, as you must in your business, on your respectful leadership, but I just thinking about having the opportunity to talk with you and meet with you, how many thousands of people you're helping who you never even meet, because by virtue of turning the cultures around, just as the toxic culture of the places I worked affected thousands over time. I mean, we may have had a staff of 400 or 500 people, depending. But then it turns over and you're talking about thousands and thousands of people over time adversely affected. Now, some of them may have liked it. Some people like to be yelled at and they can handle it. But a lot of us, I wish I would have talked to you 25 years ago, though you might have been in high school, Greg, but you know what I'm saying is I never knew quite how to handle it other than to try to work harder and try to work better.
Right.
And that kept me in jobs. It got me promoted at times, but it didn't change how I felt about things.
Exactly. And sometimes it doesn't matter how hard you work.
Yeah, no, right.
It doesn't matter at all. You could be the best of the best and still somebody would treat you just terribly.
Yeah.
And then you're forced into a position. Do I want to stick around here? I love this job. I love the people I work with, but I can't stand working for that person. Do I really want to stick this out? And some people do. And it's a real shame. And it changes. It sours them. They become bitter. Or they take it home and they take it out on the kids or they kick the dog.
Yeah.
Talk about impacts. So we like to say that respect is reciprocal. If I treat you with respect, you're very likely to treat me with respect. And it's easy. It's not that hard to do. You just have to value respect. You have to say, this is worth it. And it makes all the difference.
So simple and so hard to find. But with your great counsel, companies are finding that. And I know that they're blossoming because of it. Greg, I want to thank you so much for this engaging and informative conversation. It's just great. And I'm learning so much. And I also want to thank you for your friendship. Having said that, is there something you'd like to offer the people that are watching on how they might be able to take advantage of your vast knowledge in this arena?
Yes. I would like to offer anyone who's listening a brief, no selling, no BS, confidential call with me to talk about whatever's going on in their organization to see if I can help in some way. And I like to joke, even if you wanted to pay me for my help in that 15-minute call, I will refuse payment. I just want to be of help. 9 times out of 10, it's something that I've seen before, and I could say, well, here's one way you could address this. So anyone who's on this, who's listening to this, would like to, I'll put the link in the chat, and you could also put it in the notes.
Okay.
They can just sign up for a brief call with me, and I will be happy to help.
Greg, just terrific. And I'm not selling anything. You're really not selling anything. I can just want people to know, because you've been so kind and generous with your time with me, this guy's the real deal, and he cares, he's empathetic, and he's a lot of fun too. So if you're looking for this crucial information that can change your life, if you're working in a toxic environment or you're in a corporate environment where you think that some of this genius, in my view, can really make a change, Greg Ward's your guy. So Greg, thank you very much. Final word.
Our continuing friendship, and well done on you for what you're doing. You're doing wonderful work.
Thank you. Thank you. Final word for me. We call ourselves bully targets, but now let's aim to change the workplace for good. Thanks for watching.